Hi everyone, welcome to They See Dreamers, a brand new podcast which will transport you into the aspirational mindscapes of South Asian trailblazers and visionaries. I want to go past a singular definition of South Asians and talk to inspiring South Asian trailblazers to create a vivid tapestry of their experiences, including generations of dreams deferred, obstacles overcome, and boundaries transcended through a spirit of determination. In this episode, I'll be talking to Nila Varman. Nila is an entertainment reporter, radio host, and youth activist. She hosts a radio show called The Nila Extract, which is also the name of her educational platform on social media. She created these channels to break down stereotypes about the South Asian community, but also to provoke raw conversations about cultural taboos, such as body image and gender identity. I am so excited to talk to her about her journey so far and the ways in which culture, religion, and heritage have both helped and hindered her experiences in education and now in media. Welcome Nila Varman to They See Dreamers.
I miss being in the studio.
It's so fun. I feel so professional but also unqualified to be here. I'm like, what does this button do?
No, you are qualified. You are there for a reason. Look at you. You look so slay with the headphones.
Thanks. I've taken the photos for the socials afterwards as well. So like they'll all be there. Right, okay, let's go. Hi Nila, welcome to They See Dreamers. How are you and what's been happening in your life this week?
Hi, thank you so much for having me. It's so good to be here. I'm not bad. I think hay fever has taken over my life.
Yeah.
So I feel like, I don't think there's like any hay fever recorded deaths, but like there's a high possibility that.
I was going to say as of yet. Like this is. As of yet.
Keep your eyes peeled, might me. But other than that, I'm good. I'm just trying to enjoy what was the sunny weather that we were having in London. But yeah, I spoke too soon. Yeah. How are you?
I'm good. I'm just getting on with this new venture of audio and podcasting. And I'm very excited to talk to all of these British South Asian trailblazers, of which you are one. So the first thing I wanted to ask you about is breaking barriers in media. And I first wanted to say just huge congratulations on all your media work. It's great to see on your social media all the entertainment reporting you're doing, but also your continued cultural breaking taboos work that you've done since university, I believe. So my first question is, what were the pivotal moments growing up that made you realise this need for authentic representation in the media?
I mean, obviously, I can't speak for everyone, but I know a lot of people from marginalised communities don't really see the representation that they need growing up. At least I didn't, you know, on TV and radio and books and magazines and wherever. But it was really when I kind of became made aware of how different I could be treated within my own community that I wanted to start talking up about it, because like I grew up in a predominantly white area to like South Indian parents who were very loving and always taught me about my identity and taught me to be strong and like I love that I'm brown and I'm Tamil and all that. And even at school, like I just didn't feel much in terms of like differences. It was more so in the media, because as you might be able to tell, I like TV and film. And so I used to watch a lot of it. But yeah, there was only people who were in brown face or with really exaggerated accents. And then I went to an Indian international school for a little while. It's the worst place ever. But I kind of went there going like, okay, everyone is going to be nicer. Like I'm going to find my people. I'm going to be able to relate. I'm going to feel comfortable. And this is going to be a great way to connect with my heritage. And yeah, I can be more wrong. It was a shock, like not even a culture shock. It was more of just like a value shock. Like I didn't know that people placed value on certain themes and certain controversies that, you know, I didn't really grow up knowing about. For example, like the caste system and colorism and things like that, even language discrimination. Like it's the first time that I'd ever experienced that is when I was within my own community. So I think that really pushed me to start doing work, normalizing taboos and talking about things that are considered a taboo anyway. But yeah, I started all of this during COVID. I think it just got a little bit too much for me, you know, when you're in your room and you're not going anywhere. And I think I was quarantined for like 2 weeks in a hotel at one point. Mm-hmm. And like all of these feelings just kept rushing back. And I was like, I like to talk. I really want to say something.
Yeah.
And yeah, that's how it all began. And I couldn't have anticipated that, like, I mean, I have a long way to go, but I can't believe I am where I am right now. And I feel really, really grateful.
Yeah, and it links quite well on to my next question, actually, because obviously you've talked about this work normalizing cultural taboos and things on social media. But now you also have your job doing entertainment reporting, which I'm guessing is quite a separate job or a separate kind of mindset that you approach the entertainment reporting from. So I wanted to ask, do you see any kind of similarity between managing this double life that you have with media with how you manage your professional, maybe often Western environments, with your cultural and your home environments? Because they're very different environments as well. And is there any similarity in that, in the way you approach that?
I think it's interesting that you mention it as like differences or like different mindsets, because to me, I've always seen it as very similar and very much one thing, in the sense that, yes, I do talk about, you know, cultural taboos. I do talk about representation and discrimination and all that stuff and try to highlight communities. But at the same time, when I'm in the entertainment reporter kind of headspace, I'm still thinking about those things. Why mainly is because I never saw anyone in those spaces that looked like me either. You know, there's not many people who look like me asking the questions or being put in the room where we can speak to filmmakers and actors and activists and advocates about the way that stories are portrayed on screen. And so for me, it's very, very, it's almost intertwined, I'd say, because this definitely stemmed from, you know, the social media content creation side of things. But at the first and foremost, like, I started off as a presenter and I'm still presenting and doing things like that. So it's only from my annoying capability to ask way too many questions that people started believing in me and saying, okay, she kind of asks not so nonsensical questions, so we'll put her in front of some cool people. But the similarities, I'd say, like, obviously preparation, like, I make sure I research everything as much as I can, and I love film, and I integrate that into talking about, you know, taboos as well, because of the topics and who's being cast and maybe, you know, what they could be doing better and all that stuff. So when I actually go and watch a screening and when I'm asked to, you know, interview someone, I'm very privileged, but I'm also looking at it in an eye like, what can they be doing better? Or is there something in there that only I can relate to? And so I try to bring that in there. I did an interview with Chris Hemsworth, which feels absolutely crazy to say. Love of my life. I left that interview married. But for that one, like, I was stuck on what to wear the whole week. I was like, I want to look gorgeous, but I just didn't feel like anything felt like myself. And I ended up wearing a churidar or a kurta or whatever. And I wore jimiki as well. And I felt so at home. And I, for me, that was so important because, yes, like, that was like kind of my debut, is to look at me, guys. Now I'm interviewing cool people. But it also felt important to me to like touch back to my roots, because that's the reason why I was there in the first place. So the similarities, yes, research, yes, like staying true to yourself. It sounds cringy, but true. But also like keeping things concise and being myself, because for a long, long, long time, I'd been told, don't be yourself. But I think I wanted to see someone who was unapologetically themselves asking these questions or being in front of these people in like a small part of the industry, but it's actually a big part of this industry. So yeah, I'm just trying to be myself, man.
No, that makes so much sense. And I think it comes across so well in the work that you've done, that that authenticity is what has got you those opportunities. And I don't think that is in any way, I'm really glad you said that it doesn't feel like it's a double life. It feels like it's all part of the same mindset that you approach things with. Because I think even you mentioned you don't normally see people like yourself asking the questions. And I remember when Amol Rajan, the journalist, first got the job as the host of University Challenge. And I remember thinking all of these spaces that are so predominantly one way that there are now people who look like me, act like me, have some sense of similarity to me there. And a lot of it is just closed off to us, not because there's a physical barrier, but that descriptive representation does mean a lot. And
I love that descriptive representation. That's mm-hmm. really, really important. Yeah. I don't think enough people talk about that because mm-hmm. yes, sure, like, okay, there is a brown person on screen, but I think what people don't realize is that, like, I can relate to the family dynamics that they have. I can mm-hmm. relate to the culture references they make. References? Mm-hmm. References. My God. Sorry, guys. Am I having toothache? And I'm just like, what?
No, it fully makes sense. And I think I totally agree with you. Just this idea that all of the cultural and diversity and representation that you've championed in your social media work is the same things that make you personable and approachable and be able to have that interview technique that you're doing in entertainment reporting. It feels like it's all the same. It's the same person behind it all, right? So it's all part of the same fabric.
100%. Yeah. Like, I mean, this isn't, I feel like reporting isn't the only thing I want to do. Like, mm-hmm. I've just always been interested in film, and I hope that one day I will be the person being asked the questions, because yeah. that would be awesome. But mm-hmm. like, I just want to just be myself. Like, this mm-hmm. is me quiet and subdued today. But, yeah. you know, I just love being that way. Also because I think, you know, I don't come from like an educational background sense. I did science, okay? Like, nothing to do with what I'm doing now. I mm-hmm. always knew that I wanted to do something in the media, but like, I just don't know why I thought, like, I was like, I can do it, but I don't know how. I can do it, but I don't know how. And then suddenly it just all happened. Like, I didn't think that like the psychology student / women and children's health is suddenly going to be like doing this. Mm-hmm. So I guess the personality aspect of it, like being yourself, is really important to me, because I feel mm-hmm. like there are so many people trying to do this, and it's great that they are, but I feel like I just need people to know that, like, this is me, like, I'm not trying to be like anyone else.
So I had another question, a little bit off topic in terms of entertainment reporting, is that I saw that you interviewed Roger Federer at the red carpet for his documentary, and you took your mum to this premiere, if I'm right. Yes. First of all, that's incredible. That's my dream. I mean, I know I'm doing a South Asian podcast and things, but low-key, I would drop that in a heartbeat if I could do one episode with Roger Federer. That would make my life.
Don't put yourself in a box. You can go anywhere. This is the thing. Like, I think even if I was doing a South Asian podcast, not like, you can get in that room somehow. Yeah. Don't box yourself. What was your question?
That was amazing. And I think what I wanted to ask, in terms of you taking your amma with you for the premiere, how important is it for your parents to see and be part of the work that you're doing and celebrating your success with you?
Oh, I love this question. That's such a lovely question. Oh my God, firstly, it was wild because I'm like the biggest Roger Federer fan. I'm absolutely crazy. But at the end of the day, like, I wouldn't even know who he was unless it was for my amma and my appa.
Yeah.
And so when I got this opportunity, because I was originally just meant to interview him, and then I think someone who, you know, does the PR very, very kindly saw that I also make content and things like that and blah, blah, blah. And they very kindly invited me and my mum, or me and whoever I wanted, to watch the screening. Mm-hmm. So I immediately was like, amma, what? And my mum lives abroad, so it was like convenient timing, but she arrived mm-hmm. here. She brought a nice sari. She looked amazing. And it felt so good to take her. She'd never seen me, you know, kind of working or creating content. And I think it felt really good, because for my parents, this is a whole new industry and a whole new conversation. And sometimes I forget that they're parents for the first time too.
Yeah.
And, you know, and they're people for the first time too, and adults for the first time too. And they don't, like, you know, they come from quite different backgrounds to me. Mm-hmm. And so they're kind of learning about mm-hmm. the media industry and like the film industry and the world that I would like to be a part of as I'm learning it. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, I owe all of it to my parents, I think. Yeah, for sure. And so it's definitely very, very important to me that they see the work I'm doing, just because, like, I just want to show them how much I love them. Mm-hmm. And also, like, it's pretty cool. Like, I'm like, Omar, do you want to go meet your hero this week? Like, it feels so rewarding to show that. I went through a lot at school and, mm-hmm. You know, I wasn't like academically like exemplary, mm-hmm. But I struggled a lot, and mm-hmm. I don't think I would have gotten through that or believed that I still had something inside me if it weren't mm-hmm. for my Amman Appa. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. I mean, I'll take them anywhere. Like when I go to the Oscars in the future, like I definitely take my parents as my dates. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. I was going to say that's a really beautiful sentiment as well. Be so grateful. And I think it is something that a lot of South Asian people will resonate with. That idea that a lot has to be given up, especially by the first wave of movement when people emigrate. A lot of dreams and things that people had plans to do, they come second to basic survival, getting by the day, pursuing passions when you have a family to raise and things like this. And I think mm-hmm. I definitely resonate with that just from a lot of things that I do. I know that intergenerationally, these are dreams that lots of people would have had in my family. But yeah. I have been lucky enough that my parents have been able to put me in a position where I can pursue that and be able to mm-hmm. have their support and comfort. So
yeah, and I get really that nice. Especially like the opportunities thing, and it's nice what you said too. Like I feel very grateful that I have parents who are supporting what I want to do now. I mm-hmm. think they didn't get it for a little bit, mm-hmm. if I'm very honest. They, like, you know, I've been saying I wanted to act and I wanted to be in film since I was little. I even made a PowerPoint. I've never actually told anyone this. I made a PowerPoint presentation aww. Once because I read, I think it was Emma Stone's Wikipedia page, like back in 2013 or something. Yeah. And I saw that she made a PowerPoint presentation about why she wanted to be an actor. She put it on and her parents are like, yes. So I did that. And I put it on autoplay and I went to the toilet and I just sat and cried. And I don't know why, but like, aww. You know, I did all sorts of stuff like that. I've had arguments with my parents where they've been like, you can't do that. Like, yeah. Who knows? Like, I don't know if you can do that. Or like, mm-hmm. you know, you need to have a backup and whatever. But at the end of the day, like, they're the first people to believe in me when I don't believe in myself, even yeah. though, you know, they may not fully understand. But yeah, as I said, like, it's a learning thing, and mm-hmm. yeah, just really feel really, really lucky.
I just wanted to know a little bit more. You've kind of briefly touched upon the fact you went to international school for a little bit. Could you just mm-hmm. tell us a little bit more about your upbringing and how that upbringing and cultural background has shaped your worldview and the different things that you do? Mm.
Ooh. Well, I was born and brought up in the UK in a very fun place called the Isle of Wight. Well, I was born there, but we moved to Manchester shortly after I was born. So grew up in Manchester with my brother and my parents. Mm-hmm. And then when I was a teenager, we suddenly uprooted and moved to Singapore for a few years, which is where I went to the Indian International School. Mm-hmm. So I was there, and then I moved back when I was 17 for uni. So I've been here since I was 17. Mm-hmm. And my parents still live in Singapore, but mm-hmm. my brother's here. So that's like, it's nice. And I've got plenty of like family friends and family and whatever here. Mm-hmm. But yeah, as I was saying before, like I'm from a South Indian background. I'm Tamil, and I love being Tamil. Like Tamil is the oldest spoken language in the world. I feel like super privileged to be someone who knows how to speak Tamil and how to understand Tamil and how to love it. And my parents have always, always just encouraged that mm-hmm. side of me. Mm-hmm. I think there was definitely a period of time where I was embarrassed highly of my heritage, mm-hmm. and that was when I was in the Indian International School. Yeah, when I was little living here, like I was embarrassed to wear my Indian clothes mm-hmm. in public places and things like that. But then it was when I was in the international school where I was actually ashamed to be South Indian because of a lot of stereotypes and negative connotations that people were putting on me before I could even figure myself out. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I spent a while kind of trying to erase that side of myself, trying to be like the South Asian, the Indian that people wanted me to be, and mm-hmm. the kind that I thought made me more desirable or interesting or would have more friends or whatever. But I think it was only when I came back to the UK on my own that I was able to like sit with those thoughts and slowly started to break out of that. Because I went from someone who was extremely proud to extremely like, ew, and then suddenly, yay, behind closed doors, I was like super proud of my identity, but I wouldn't tell anyone that, for example, like I love South Indian classical music, Carnatic music. I've been doing it since I was 3 mm-hmm. and I was doing performances all the time and I was playing the violin and I sing vocal and things like that. For example, I would like hide from my friends. Mm. They'd be like, where are you going? And I'd be like, oh yeah, you know, just guitar class or like something like that. Yeah. I'd just lie. Mm-hmm. I'd never tell them that I was performing in a temple or like in a stage or whatever it is. Like, I just hide those parts of myself. I made my mum stop oiling my hair. I did various things like that. I try not to speak Tamil in front of my North Indian friends because they'd make fun of me. And like, yeah, I'd pretend I'd watched Bollywood movies just to seem relevant, but actually I've watched about three.
I used to do this all the time. People would be singing Hindi songs as if there wasn't a huge Indian community in Stoke-on-Trent anyway, which is where I grew up. There was like nothing there.
Stoke-on-Trent. Yeah. Okay. My brother's actually studying there now, so I've been there quite a lot.
A lot of them would talk about all these Hindi songs in Bollywood films and their favourite Bollywood actor. And I'd kind of Google to keep up with it and I'd pick my favourites just to stay in the conversation. But realistically, I didn't have any association with that side of Indian culture. And it wasn't in any sort of disrespect to that. It was just not what I grew up with. And that kind of links quite well to my next question, which is, I listened to a BBC Radio Nottingham interview that you did where I went deep. You talked about your South Indian heritage, obviously, as you've mentioned already here. And you've mentioned that you identify more as South Indian or Tamil than you do South Asian or Desi, particularly Desi. Mm-hmm. Could you explain a little bit more about why that specific identity matters to you and what it is about the word Desi that you don't necessarily associate with?
Can't believe you went and listened to
It's research. I was watching Louis Theroux and I thought, okay, he knows everything about the people that he's interviewing. This is the level I need to read.
I love this. Well, I mean, to be fair, it wasn't that long ago. Like, that was a proud part. Like, I was doing a segment with Hansa Dobby, who is sadly no longer working there, but she was really cool. I think, like, I do identify as South Asian. I think that's definitely part of like my identity, but as you said, like, I'm way more comfortable just saying I'm Tamil or that I'm South Indian. Desi to me, like, even when I say it, like, it feels uneasy, like I feel queasy even when I hear it, because it's been a term that has very much felt like it's not inclusive of people from my community and from, I know, other communities in South Asia as well. I feel like there's, you know, a lot of as you said, like, you know, the Googling Bollywood actors, for example, and like, you know, I did anything I could to fit in. I don't even understand Hindi. Okay. I just stand there and I'd be like, please speak English. And they'd be like, no, you learn Hindi. And I'm like, what? Like, I just stand there and they'd be like, you're not Desi enough. You're not this enough. Like, oh, don't you know any Desi memes? It would be like very much a word that was used against me when it was supposed to be something that's meant to unite people and, you know, call a collectivistic group as Desi. For me, I associate Desi with North India. I don't know why, but I think it might just be because it doesn't feel very inclusive of the Tamil community, of the South Indian community, you know, everywhere, not just in India, obviously. But yeah, I just feel like it's always just been not welcoming to me. And I've never felt like I could attach with it. And like, I would never, ever call myself Desi. Like, it just doesn't make sense. Whereas I think people don't understand, but like, being Tamil, it's more than just a language. It's a community. It's not just localized to one place. It's not just South India. It's Sri Lanka. It's Canada. It's South Africa. Like, Tamil people are everywhere. And it's a culture and it's like a heritage. And like, it feels more comfortable because I, first and foremost, I'm Tamil. Like, that's what I identify with. And the South Indian part of it, I'm also really proud of, because I love, you know, tapping into other South Indian cultures and watching like Malayali content or Telugu content or like, you know, stuff from Karnataka or wherever, or like Sri Lanka or wherever. Like, you know, I just think that Desi has just been something that's been weaponized against me. It's been the root of many ongoing jokes. I don't associate it with good things. I don't know if that made sense.
No, I think it does make sense. But, and I think I mentioned to you, because we had a little chat before, and I remember you mentioned, I'm not sure if I fully associate with the term Desi. And I think I'm the same. The title of the podcast, as we speak, is Desi Dreamers. However, like, looking more broadly than that, I think as a term, there are lots of issues with the way that people think of India as a monolith, or think of even the South Asian experience as one entity. And I think that's one of the major things I want to unpack with this series, is the idea that if you drive 20 minutes, you could be speaking a completely different language, not even a dialect. There will be language differences in India. It's such a huge country with so much cultural richness. And I think to think of it as one thing, or to think there is like one cuisine, music, culture, there's so much more to one country. And then if you're looking more broadly, Bangladesh, Pakistan, Sri Lanka, like there's so much. So kind of linking to that, I guess, is that in terms of that identity, but then also your British identity, do you ever feel that you are too Indian to be British, but too British to be Indian?
I mean, firstly, defo agree. I think it's a massive stereotype that people just think that, or generalization, I guess. Like, India is just one place, and wherever I go, there'll be like Rogan Josh and Jal Frazee and Vindaloo, or whatever. Those aren't even, whatever. But it's just, I think people forget that there, it's so diverse. And even within, you know, South India, you've got like, as you said, 10 minutes, 20 minutes drive away, completely different foods, cultures, traditions, and only one aspect of it is really represented in the mainstream. So people, unfortunately, don't even get to see what's beyond that stereotypical representation. So that hopefully will change. And secondly, I think with the too British to be Asian, too Asian to be Brit, wait. I think I mixed that up. But I mean, to agree with what you said, I do feel like sometimes I feel like I'm not Indian enough, and I feel like I'm not British enough, for sure. I think I've stopped caring about it as much as I did in the past when I first started my show and my platform. It's very much like my first episode is called Not Indian Enough, because I felt like I just wasn't enough at all. Like, I wasn't the skin color that people wanted me to be in my own community. I was made fun of because of the language I speak by my own community, just because it's associated with like various issues. And some people would even make fun of me because of caste, which is dumb. And as we were talking about earlier, the language discrimination and language hierarchy ever welcome in spaces that were brown. Whereas part of my British identity, a big thing is with my name. It's a very small name, but I still have to say name is, it sounds like vanilla without the va, because either they don't pronounce my name properly, which is fine because they're trying to learn, or they ask how it's pronounced and they're like, is there an easier way to say it? Or they say the wrong thing completely, or they say, I'm gonna call you, and that's the worst one. But there's that aspect of it. And the second, it's probably, I think, you know, growing up, there was always like, why do you have so much body hair? Like, why can we see your body hair? Or like, I don't understand why you celebrate this. It wasn't like jarring per se, but there's microaggressions that make me feel too Indian, too not British enough, I guess. But for me, it's like a very much a balanced thing. Like, it feeds into each other. I don't think it, you know, I don't think I'd associate it as one or the other, but they contribute to my identity in different ways. Even like people assuming that for some reason I'm like the Indian Yellow Pages, as if I know every single Indian on the planet the minute they see that I'm brown. Or they just assume that I know Bollywood dancing. If they press a button, I'll break out into sing song. Or even though I don't know anything about Bollywood and I'm more of a Kutu fan, like no one's going to know unless they ask. So yeah, I do resonate it with some, with like a lot of it, but I've stopped caring about it a lot. Yeah. I think I've just been trying to like focus on how I see myself. And like, if someone doesn't make me feel welcome in that space, I think I'm more focused on like how to deal with that and how to like respond. Yeah.
I think that makes sense. And I think also, I'm not sure if this is your experience, but definitely from my experience, I think I've stopped caring about that cultural duality as much as I grow up, because I'm starting to find my communities and find the ways in which I can express both sides of whatever seems to be a clashing identity without it seeming like a clash. That is just my identity. And especially transitioning to university, where I am just seeing a lot more South Asian people, that it seems like that is more of a commonality. That has helped me a lot.
Did you ever find that you were like trying to separate the two? Because I think I went through, like, especially in first year of uni, I wasn't really sure where I fit in still. Mm-hmm. Like, I moved back here. I was desperate to come home and be around people who didn't really care about, like, colorism mm. and stuff. Mm-hmm. And then when I went to uni, I tried to join like the societies mm. and like I felt like I was in school all over again. So mm. I never joined the Tamil society or the Hindu society, the Indian society. They all felt really, really it just didn't feel welcome to me, and they were still associating stereotypes and whatever, and people were still speaking in Hindi and expecting me mm. to just know and all that stuff. And so actually I think in total I had one brown friend in first year, maybe two. And it's only after I left university that I found a group of Indian friends mm. or just South Asian friends, mm-hmm. British South Asian friends, or like, you know, people from South Asia who've lived in Dubai or mm-hmm. wherever. And like, I actually never had that. I mm. never had like a group. And it really did help because I saw the way that like certain things that would occur to me happen in other people. For some reason, I thought that, you know, like as a brown person, I shouldn't be feeling this way, or like this shouldn't look like this on this person or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. So I definitely get what you mean. I don't try to separate it anymore because it's just one thing. And mm-hmm. I didn't understand that for years. I just didn't. I think it was only third year where I started slowly having one or two more brown friends. I was still very much scarred and I thought I wouldn't be very welcome.
Mm.
So I think I just had one brown friend in first year, just one.
Wow. You went to university in Nottingham.
I did.
Yeah.
So I did. I went to Nottingham and then mm-hmm. I went to King's.
Yeah. Okay, nice. I went to the London School of Economics. So there was a bigger South Asian community in general. There was still a lot of segregation between different Indian groups. The Hindu society was much more of a British Indian society, whereas mm-hmm. the India society was Indian international students. And yeah. the cultural difference between that was huge. And I did not realise how huge it was going to be. I kind of went for a couple of freshers events. I was like, ah.
It's also even with the Hindu stuff, like I didn't really know where I fit in because I'm not very like religious or orthodox either. Mm-hmm. Like I was just like, what's going on? And I was like, I don't even think I believe in God. Like, what am I doing here? Like, it was just like, what qualifies me to be an H? Yeah, that was a time.
I think it's interesting to hear more about your cultural upbringing and your inspirations behind that. And I guess I wanted to ask how that translated into your activism and the work that you've done on social media. So you have your online activism and you also have your award-winning radio show, The Nila Extract, which is all about trying to amplify the voices of marginalised communities, but also bringing together the South Asian community. So I just wanted to know a little bit more about how you launched The Nila Extract. What was your inspiration and how did you go about achieving this dream?
Yeah, I mean, to answer the first bit of your question, I think, you know, the activism side of things, like, it's very much, as I said, like, I've always just wanted to speak about these things, because at the time, even, like, there was not enough people who looked like me who were even bringing up these issues. There wasn't, TikTok wasn't even a big thing back then, for example. Like, it was just Instagram, and I'd scroll on it, and I wouldn't see anyone talking about this who looked like me, or I felt like just I didn't feel very understood, mm-hmm. if that made sense. And for a long time, I'd been thinking about, you know, trying to create more spaces for myself where I didn't see people like myself in. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, during lockdown, like, there was no university societies that were open. And the only one that was open was radio, because it's you produce yourself, you're in a studio. And I was like, I've been wanting to do this for so long, it looks kind of boring, but I'll try. And I went and I fell in love with it. And I knew that this is what I wanted to talk about. It's the thing that I was most passionate about. It's the thing that I'd speak to my parents most about and rant about and talk to my friends about. And I'd just come to a point where I was like, enough is enough. Like, I at least I can talk about it. And maybe one or two people are going to listen, but at least I'll feel like they're not alone there.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I just went, I don't write scripts or anything like that for my episodes. So I just kind of sat down and I just went, blah, blah, blah. And I remember that first episode was mad because my whole family was listening from abroad. I didn't tell them what I was going to talk about. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a lot of my friends were listening and my dad's friends were listening. Wow. And my dad called me and he was like laughing, like hysterically after I did that first episode, because I called out all of these issues and I spoke about situations that he'd gone through as like a 50-year-old. I'd been like, my dad has experienced discrimination, like my mum has done. I talked about all this stuff and he called me and he's laughing and he was just like, you've just spoken about everything I've experienced in 1 hour and I couldn't do it in 50 years. And I still remember that phone call. He was literally like laughing. Like, I've never heard him laugh like that in my life. And he was so proud and he was literally like, like, I can't even imitate it. But that's when I knew that, like, even my dad at 50 needs a bit of representation, you know? Like, I think I wanted my content to be accessible for people, regardless of the age, so that whatever age you are, you can come back to it and be like, huh, I can learn something new today. Or even more importantly, I can unlearn something today. So started my show, started putting things on. If you scroll right to the bottom, it's embarrassing. But it's just like really badly made posts being like, this is my show. And then I think I had an episode with Dr. Jane Goodall, who I'm not sure if you know, but like she did a lot of incredible work. She was one of my first big guests. And I was like, what? But she said something like, Nilla, you know, you've got this Instagram. You've got about like, I don't know, 200, maybe 10 followers, just 10 followers or whatever. And she was like, you can still make a massive difference. She said something like that. And so I started doing a series called Misconception Mondays. And I would like do a dual talky thing. I'd be myself and also like a Karen version of myself to make content like this about topics which are kind of difficult to talk about at times, more accessible and more readily available to people so that they could share it. So I started doing that and I started getting excited about that. And then I started making posts about issues. And then I was like, okay, people seem to resonate with bite-sized information because my attention span is terrible. So I was like, this is working. Like I can try doing it more. I seem to be reaching more people. And so it just went on from there. And I started like trying to just explore all aspects of, you know, my personality and my interests. And whenever there's something I just don't agree with, I start yapping about it. But I've never like ever forced myself to post when I don't want to post. I think I wait till I actually want to say something. Because in the past, like even on some podcasts, people are like, what's your posting schedule been like? I'm like, I've never had one of those in my life. Like, it would very much just be me trying to find people from all sorts of different communities because I have so much to learn and talk to them and get their perspective on things. And then kind of convert that into an episode or convert that into like a Misconception Monday or convert that into like another video. And so now I've just like come to a point where I'm just trying to find what works for me, but also what works for others. You know, regardless, be, you know, interviewing people on air or on video or wherever it is. So yeah, I think it definitely translates into all aspects.
It really does. And I think the follow-up question that I wanted to ask you in relation to that is, what sort of challenges have you faced as a young woman of colour or a South Asian woman in creating space for those taboo conversations?
Well, not everyone agrees with what I say. And that's fine. That's absolutely fine. But I think it took me a long time to realise that that's also fine. You know, I'm putting my views out there because these are my views, and a lot of people don't even resonate with what I say because they haven't had the same life experiences, and that's totally fine. But I also realize that I can't talk about everything and everything and anything. Like, I think I put a lot of pressure on myself to be on top of every single awareness day and every single like day where I could like make content and share with people. But the truth is, like, I can't. Some people would message me being like, thanks for talking about this, but why haven't you spoken about this? And I'm like, one, because I'm still learning about it. And two, this is my platform. You know, I didn't realize how helpful telling yourself that you have agency is, because your platform, at the end of the day, you know, your content, your way. Another challenge, I guess, has just been like insecurity, because I think talking about a lot of these things brings up a lot of these things in my head. And, you know, I've had to like deal with certain emotions and certain like traumas and stories and have conversations with my parents. And sometimes I've even gone down rabbit holes just researching one thing and like, it's not always been healthy for me. But other than that, I don't know. I'm sure there's been many challenges. Mm-hmm. I think I just haven't really like sat and thought about it in a while. Yeah. I'm very much like, oh, woe is me. And then like, I like complain about it for a week. I think right now I'm struggling a bit with comparison mm-hmm. and time. Mm-hmm. I think I've kind of been like, oh my God, I'm 23 and I'm not where I want to be. And I've forgotten to actually enjoy where I am right now. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And the comparison part is so easy. Like just following people on social media, you just see like, why don't I look like them? Why don't I sound like them? Or like, why is it that they're putting out stuff that, you know, isn't very, I guess some of it's misinformation, and why do they have so many views or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. But like, yeah, I've started doing random things to look after myself, I guess, like detoxing my feed, unfollowing people who make me feel uncomfortable, or just trying to read more, reflect more and take it as it comes. Mm-hmm.
That's really interesting. And I think there's a real tendency for even people who we see as aspirational or role models or in any way we want to follow. It's not all a go, go, go. There has to be time where we have to relax and take time to ourselves, because to be in an industry where you are breaking barriers or trailblazing or in some way going against the grain or saying something that you've not been able to say before, it is in some way draining. As much as it is empowering, there is also a sense of which you need to look after yourself in between those moments. And I think that makes a lot of sense.
100%. And it's also like the unlearning aspect of it. Like, mm-hmm. I don't know everything. I'm not the spokesperson for every community. Mm-hmm. I have so much to learn, and I'm sure I have a lot to unlearn too. And I think I'm just trying to navigate that myself. Like, even if I talk about things like, I don't know, body confidence or acceptance or colorism mm-hmm. or, you know, anti this or anti that, I've also been that person in the past, I'm sure, mm-hmm. you know, like unintentionally or intentionally. And so it's really just trying to be honest with myself and take the time that I need. Like, I think I used to be like on my stories, like, hi guys, not posting this week because I'm taking a break to research. I'm just like, that's all just a bunch of poo now. Like, I just take it if I need to take it. I disappeared for 6 months, like when I went through a breakup recently, just because I wanted to. Didn't feel like I owed it to anyone. I just needed to focus on myself. At the end of the day, I think it's just important that your platform, your schedule, mm-hmm. but also be honest and mm-hmm. try to represent communities or whoever you're representing the best light possible. Because for a lot of people, this is the first time that they're seeing people like you and me in mm-hmm. these spaces. And so I think everyone has a responsibility, regardless if they've got 5 followers or 2 or like whatever, mm-hmm. to try to do that mm-hmm. in the most honest way possible. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. And one particular topic that I wanted to unpack more with you is colorism. So we've mentioned mm-hmm. this a couple of times, and it's actually based off the fact that recently you made a video on Instagram that I saw about the Fair and Lovely cream rebranding to Glow mm-hmm. and Lovely. So just for the benefit of the listeners, colorism is essentially a similar derogatory or discriminatory attitude to racism, but in the sense of the shade of your skin in terms of how light or dark it is. And within the South Asian community, it's often lighter skinned people that are seen as more beautiful or more attractive. So I just wanted to ask, what are your experiences with colorism in the Indian community? And what was it about this topic that made you want to make that short video when you saw that rebranded cream?
I mean, I feel like that's a whole episode in itself, for sure. Yeah. But I love the explanation of what you said, because even the word fair, like it sounds weird, like they're treated fairly.
Yeah.
You know? Like, I think for eons, there's been like a divide in a way, again, unconsciously sometimes and intentionally sometimes. But yeah, unfortunately, like, as you said, again, like, I think lighter skin tones are associated with more worth and more desirability and more, you know, for some people, they're not even educated if they're a different skin tone. Like, there's so many things to unpack there. But for me personally, like, growing up, it was fine. It was only when I was around people who looked like me, because there was also like an undertone of, you know, South Indians are all dark skin, and for some reason that's ugly and I don't want to be compared to that, you know? And it was just like, well, my parents, like my dad has dark skin. I, in this light, look very lighter skin, but I also have darker skin. My brother has lighter skin. Like, it doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. I think for a long time, I did like think that my skin tone defined my worth. And mm-hmm. like, I went through a phase where I was like trying to actually rub my skin to make myself look fairer. Yeah. And that's not very good at all. Mm-hmm. Please don't do that, anyone who's listening. But it was because I also just never saw anyone on screen who looked like me. It was like in the movies, anyone with darker skin would be the butt of a joke or like not there at all. Mm. Whoever was represented in mainstream Western media was also light skinned, and that's fine. But like, who is it helping? Mm. And I was stuck in an industry, you know, watching a literal white person from Liverpool pretending to be an Indian person in a lot of Tamil movies.
Wild.
Yeah. And so, you know, you come from like a culture where like everyone's like, oh, well, you need to look like her. And I'm like, you actually can't, babe. She's white. And, you know, like it was just various instances like that. Even getting ready for weddings in India, they cake your skin with like what like looks like cement to make you look brighter. Or people asking me if I wanted to bleach my skin at such a young age. Or when I came from the UK to India, they'd all be like, oh my god, she's back, she's fair, she's beautiful. And then when I get a tan, they'd be like, oh no, her color's gone, don't go into the sun. There's like so many things that have kind of impacted me. And it was only when I sat and thought about it and it all pieced together mm-hmm. that I wanted to talk about it, because it's an issue that's still occurring today. Like with Fair and Lovely, they thought that they could just change the name to Glow and Lovely and it wouldn't make a difference, but still the same cream. It's still the same person promoting it. And they're just using the word glow instead of fair. But it's the same ideology. And I feel like the damage has already been done a little bit. Mm-hmm. So I think it's very important to talk about colorism.
Yeah.
I think it's very, very important because it integrates into things like caste-based discrimination and and also other things and religious divides and honor killing. And there's like so many things. And I don't think people realize how severe it can be. Mm-hmm. It just crept up on me. It was literally just in the shop downstairs. And I was like, what? Like, I've seen this in India. Why is it here? Mm-hmm. Why are people buying it? Why is it an affordable price? Why is no one talking about the fact that the name has changed? And like when I posted on my story, people were like, oh, I don't think that's very lovely. I think that's just like a cream for glow. And I was like, no, this is a name change. It's the same brand. And I just realized how many people thought it was a completely different product. Mm-hmm. So then I was just like, yeah, got to make this video. And I'd spoken about it before, like colorism and the beauty and cosmetic industry. I've spoken about it in the past. But as I said, like, I just feel like there's nothing wrong in repeating a video and talking about something new. And that day I was angry. Mm-hmm. So it just had to come out.
And I think it's really powerful that you did that on your Instagram platform, because you're also posting all of this entertainment reporting that you're doing. And say if someone has come across you through a small clip from an interview that you've done with Chris Hemsworth, they will then come across your other work and then see the different things that you're interested in, or or come across different patterns in South Asian culture that are both beautiful but also things that are potentially hindering mindsets.
Yeah,
and 100%. I think they all exist together. So I think it's really important that you've done that, and really great.
Thank you. I really, like, that's what I want to do essentially, is that, like, you know, the entertainment reporting is part of who I am, is part of what I do. But at the end of the day, like, I'm still sitting here talking about issues that aren't really spoken about much. Mm-hmm. And I want everyone to realize that entertainment reporting is integrating with representation, and being in that is it all connects. Mm-hmm. And so I think I just wanted my platform to be like almost a hub where people can come to learn and unlearn and learn about these things if they want to or not want to. And yeah, the entertainment reporting is pretty cool too. And before that, I was just doing like interviews and organizing them myself and trying to get where I could. So it's just like, yeah, I'm really, really grateful. And
yes, and I think that's a really good note to go on to my final question, which is, do you think of yourself as a dreamer? I feel like often we get told not to daydream and not to get distracted, but to concentrate. But do you think that potentially there's sometimes a necessity to fantasize about a reality that we don't necessarily have, to eventually break those boundaries and be a trailblazer?
Very kind of you to think I'm a trailblazer. It's very nice to, I don't know how I feel. Yeah, it's very interesting. I know your podcast called Desi. Mm-hmm. What is under that? Even with that, I feel like if it was to be more inclusive, like what you're doing now, like I'd be readily happy to unlearn and accept that part. Mm-hmm. But with the dreamers part, like, I've always daydreamed. I'm the most chatty and unfocused person ever at times. And it's only because I kind of went this is what I want to do because I want to do it, that I'm doing it, if mm-hmm. that makes sense. And I think it's so important to encourage people to dream because, like, I saw this, like, I used to watch Lupita Nyong'o's Oscar speech, like, again and again when I was mm-hmm. younger, and she says something like, you know, wherever you're from, your dreams are valid. And it seems very, very simple to hear that, mm-hmm. but it's true because people mm-hmm. think that just because you're in this background or because your parents aren't from here or your parents don't know about this or the people around you don't know about this, that you can't achieve what you want to achieve. And I'm still very much figuring that out. I'm not where I want to be and I'm trying my best and I'm mm-hmm. learning and, you know, I'm trying to teach myself a lot about how to get there. But it's very easy to just believe that, you know, if you dream less and actually focus more, then you'll get there. But like, if you're not dreaming, then that's a huge part of you gone. Like yeah. my whole identity has been the fact that, like, since I was a kid, all I've said is like, I'm going to win an Oscar one day. It's been literally my identity for the longest time. I win one or not, doesn't matter, whatever, I will. But it's also just like something I truly believe that can mm-hmm. happen. And the way that I'm trying to get there, mm-hmm. I'm trying to get into those spaces, might be different from what I imagine, but it doesn't come without dreaming and family encouraging me to fantasize and dream and think about things which many people think people like us can't do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Absolutely. And finally, are there any other inspirational Desi dreamers that you want to give a shout out to? Any of your role models?
But there's so many. I think an obvious one would be Aman Appa, like yeah. my brother as well. Mm-hmm. I feel like he's, you know, been a big supporter throughout all of this, and whatever content I put out, he's always someone to criticize me in the right way. I think mm-hmm. a lot of people don't tell me what looks wrong or what looks right. So yeah, mm-hmm. my family for sure. Also, I'd say you, because you're, you know, becoming part of a lovely community, which is striving to amplify minority communities. So yeah.
Oh, that's really sweet. Thank you so much. And thank you so much, Nila Varman, for joining me on Desi Dreamers.
Thank you for having me. It's been an honor to be here.
Thank you so much for listening to Desi Dreamers. I hope this story was a powerful reminder of the incredible resilience, creativity, and determination that defines the South Asian diaspora. We've taken a journey which has explored the cultural influences, personal challenges, and transformative moments that have shaped a unique narrative. Each episode of Desi Dreamers is a testament to the fact that our stories matter. That representation isn't just about seeing ourselves reflected, but about understanding the complex, beautiful journeys that bring us to our most authentic selves. Importantly, our cultural heritage is not a limitation, but our greatest source of strength. Desi Dreamers is powered by Transmission Roundhouse and is available on all major podcast platforms. Make sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts so you never miss an episode. And if you love today's story, please leave a review and share it with anyone who needs to hear about these incredible journeys. Next time, I'll be diving into another incredible story that proves our dreams have no boundaries. Until then, keep dreaming, keep believing, and most importantly, keep being unapologetically you. I'm Nikita Nachipan, and this has been Desi Dreamers.